It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an aerospace engineer says it's time to get serious about pollution in Earth's orbit.
First, last summer, Governor Scott Walker and Republicans in the legislature approved a law that requires all doctors who perform abortions in a state to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of their clinic.
That regulation was put on hold, awaiting a court ruling on legal challenges. The trial begins today, began earlier today. It's expected to last through the week.
WPR reporter Gilman Halstead joins us from the courthouse now. Gil, good to have you.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
Well, this ruling has been on hold pending the court's decision. What's the crux of the legal disagreement here?
Well, the crux is that the people challenging the law, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, is that the law is unnecessary and will actually make it difficult for a large number of women to get an abortion because it will require the closing of a clinic where doctors who perform the abortions there have not been able to get the admitting privileges that the law requires.
And as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports it, they're contending also that certain doctors are being treated differently and, I guess, unfairly compared to other doctors. Is that something that you're seeing unfold?
Well, I don't know if I could use that value judgment being treated unfairly.
Well, that would be their argument, not.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I haven't even heard it stated that it's been unfair. It's more than that they have found it difficult to get these admitting privileges for a number of reasons that have been discussed during the testimony today. One is that the doctors contend that the hospitals don't want to give them admitting privileges because they won't be admitting very many patients, so they won't be providing business to the hospital, and the doctors, you know, find that sort of ironic because the reason that they are being asked to get admitting privileges is because there may be complications which are very rare, and so in order for them to get privileges, it would sort of, I mean, it sounds odd, but they would have to be able to guarantee that there'd be more complications in a procedure that is, by evidence, very rare. The other reason is that they believe some of the hospitals are concerned about having doctors that perform abortions having admitting privileges at their hospital, that stigma that might lead to protests outside of a hospital. All of the three doctors that testified today all talked about experiencing regular harassment in their work at the clinics as well as at their homes sometimes with threats and people going to their house, to their neighborhoods and knocking on doors and telling their neighbors that their neighbor is a murderer or a baby killer.
Now, should this law go into effect, how would different clinics in the state be affected?
Well, the contention of the people of the ACLU and Planned Parenthood is that because they haven't been able to get the admitting privileges required by the law, that they would have to close, one clinic would have to close in Milwaukee, and the other clinics where some doctors have finally been able to get admitting privileges would have to take up the slack. And that would mean a much bigger load at those clinics, and it would mean that abortions would be delayed to later in the gestational period of the pregnancy, which makes them riskier, and that many people, women who, you know, don't want to be delayed for obvious reasons would end up having to go out of state and sometimes would not be able to do that just because of the time and expense involved in doing that, and therefore would be their health would be put at risk.
Now, this case is expected to last about 4 days with the ruling,
right,
a decision coming within the next week or so after that. What has the scene been like at the courthouse today?
Well, it's been, I'd say it's been peaceful. There aren't any protesters outside, if that's what you mean. But this last bit of testimony that we've just been, I've just been listening to just before this call, has focused on some rather graphic descriptions of the few complications that at least one of these doctors was involved in having to deal with after she performed an abortion at a clinic and the patient had to be taken to a hospital. So that's been kind of a little bit difficult to listen to, and there have been some objections from the defense about how graphic things need to get in describing the problem. So that's, other than that, it's just been this. You know, these witnesses are the ACLU Planned Parenthood witnesses, and so they have sort of friendly questions, I guess you might call it, being asked of them, and then it's in the cross-examination from the Department of Justice attorneys that things get a little bit contentious.
Now, there are other states with similar laws, either on the books or in legal challenges we are seeing here in Wisconsin. How does Wisconsin's law, as it stands, compare to the rest of the country?
It's essentially the same law that's been challenged or enforced. As I understand it, there are actually 8 states that have this law in effect. And I think we heard just in the story that Kristen Durst read from the Associated Press that Alabama and Mississippi, the law is on hold in a similar way here. And in Texas, it was upheld after a court challenge.
And is there a chance that this will make it to the Supreme Court?
I don't know if I can make that kind of prediction, but I think it would be safe to predict that it's going to, no matter which way Judge Connolly here rules on it, it's going to end up at the 7th District Court of Appeals in Chicago, one side or the other, depending on how he rules. Well, I think it's pretty much guaranteed to appeal it to that level.
And Gil, I want to ask you that one thing, one feature of the next 4 days in what's being decided there at the court is that there will be a trio of experts who will be sort of talking amongst each other, trying to get at some of the issues here. Can you describe what's going to happen then?
I have I can't, Veronica, because I haven't been able to talk to any of the attorneys about what the sort of order of events is going to be in the trial. I mean, we heard 3 experts today, if that's what you're referring to, the ACLU's experts, and we're going to be hearing the Department of Justice witnesses as well, who will be supporting the law. I guess I hadn't heard that there was going to actually be an interchange between experts. I mean, they're going to be on the stand.
Right, and it's something I'd read in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article again, and it's. I wish I could fill in more than my question, but it will be a trio of experts who will be kind of talking to each other, trying to get at different aspects of the case, but we can hear more about that as it unfolds later in the week.
Yeah, I look forward to being able to describe that to you, but there hasn't been any discussion about what that's going to be like. I was just expecting that we're going to hear doctors who have performed abortions who, as I said, the ACLU doctors say, feel the law is both unnecessary and will cause problems for women, and those who say that we really need to have this law to protect the health of women.
And we'll leave it there. Gil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Gil Halstead, WPR reporter, covering the trial of Wisconsin's law that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. We hear a lot about pollution in the water and the air and the earth, but our next guest is setting his sights higher in our planet's orbit.
Tom Percy joins us now. He's an engineer, and he's a doctoral student in aerospace systems engineering at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. In a recent paper he co-wrote in the journal Space Policy, he makes the case that orbital debris is a threat to working satellites and the International Space Station, and that it's time for a cleanup. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tom, first of all, what is this debris? Where is it coming from in our orbit?
Well, we've been flying satellites in Earth orbit for over 55 years now, and we have a lot of satellites up there that are doing jobs like weather prediction and resource monitoring and communications. But over time, we've left a lot of things up there as well. Old satellites that they don't function anymore, rockets that took those satellites to orbit. And right now, of all the objects that we track in low Earth orbit especially, 96% of those objects are non-functioning things. Many of them are fragments of old satellites. So that leaves us with only about 415 active satellites and a whole lot of junk floating around them.
And how much of a threat is that junk to the good stuff, the stuff that's still working?
Well, all of that stuff is traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. And so you can imagine a freeway with a whole bunch of intersections and things moving very, very quickly. For the 415 active satellites, if we can see the objects, we can get out of their way and try to avoid running into them. But for many of the objects that are no longer controlled, when they run into each other, they create smaller debris, things larger than a marble, but smaller than a softball, and we estimate there are about 500,000 of those objects in low Earth orbit, each one of which could potentially be fatal if it collides with a satellite.
And there are a few people up there at the International Space Station. Have they been at risk? Have they had to dodge any of this?
They do from time to time. The orbit that the space station is in is relatively low in population, kind of by design. Mm-hmm. But from time to time, they do encounter objects that come within a certain distance of the space station. And they will have the crew get into their escape capsules and be ready to abandon the station if they have to. It's never come to that, thankfully, but there is a potential threat there.
In your paper, you make the case for some urgency. Why do we need to act soon on orbital debris?
Well, there's an idea called the Kessler syndrome that talks about the populations of these orbits increasing to the point where collisions become sort of a self-perpetuating chain reaction. And in cases like that, we can see very quickly an orbit becoming unusable. Too many objects to put an active satellite because it just stands too much of a risk of being hit by other things. For a long time, we operated under what was the big sky theory, that the sky is pretty big and satellites are pretty small. And in 2009, we had a collision between an active communication satellite and an old, unfunctioning Russian satellite. It was the first time that that had happened, and it was kind of a wake-up call to the community that maybe the big sky theory wasn't exactly the way we want to operate. And there are some orbits that are very highly populated right now with many communication satellites and lots of debris. And so we're getting close to the point where some of those chain reaction events might actually take place.
In the meantime, more countries and more companies are sending up new stuff, right?
That's right. That's right. 20 years ago, there were only 15 countries, in the world that had satellites in orbit. Today, that number is 45, and it's becoming easier to fly satellites. The emergence of things like CubeSats that are relatively inexpensive, small, easy to make, actually lend themselves to student research opportunities. And so it's becoming that much easier to fly things in orbit as we get better at it.
Has there ever been an idea that when you send something up, you have to have a disposal plan, what it's going to do when it's done?
There are guidelines. Different licensing agencies within our country and then around the world and other space agencies have guidelines like something we call the 25-year rule, which says that you have to remove your satellite from orbit within 25 years of the end of its life. Unfortunately, they're not hard and fast rules, they're guidelines, and they sometimes are at odds with the economics of spaceflight. Satellites are expensive, and the longer they can stay up, the more revenue they can generate. And sometimes we just lose communication with the satellite before it has a chance to begin its deorbit procedure. And so what we're left with is a whole bunch of leftover satellites floating around waiting to run into something.
Oh, so if I've got a satellite and I have a choice between using its last little bit of juice to keep it working for 2 years or to move it and have it burn up in orbit, I might get that extra couple years out of it.
It's very tempting.
So there are two challenges, it seems like, to cleaning this up. Technical, which I want to get into in a minute, but policy, I want to start with. Who makes the decision on how to start cleaning this up, and what does it take to convince them to do that?
Sure. So the policy aspect is almost the more challenging of the two. A lot of people think of space kind of in the same vein of maritime law, where you can salvage things if you want to. That's actually not the case. The UN, the Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space, or COPUS, has set up some guidelines for how we're going to operate. And in space, the launching state, United States, Russia, China, owns those objects forever. And if we were to go up and try to retrieve an object that wasn't ours, that is in violation of international treaty. So ownership and liability become issues, along with the fact that if you develop something that can go harvest old space junk and deorbit it, You've also developed a platform that can harvest active satellites, which brings us into the realm of dual-use technology or weapons in space, which always makes people a little nervous.
Well, what would it take to have an international agreement that starts getting stuff out of orbit? Who would have to be at the table?
I think all the players are at the table. It's just a long process to discuss the ownerships and liabilities. There's an organization called the IADC that comprises 12 of the world space agencies, NASA, the Japanese Space Agency, the Russian Space Agency, Europeans. And they're discussing regulations and liabilities and ownerships and those sorts of things on the global level. And at the same time, there are space agencies actively looking at ways to at least remove the things that they own. So there are steps being taken in the right direction, but it's a slow process when you're talking about international policy.
Well, yeah, it seems like there might be players out there who think, gosh, this is expensive. I've got a lot of other stuff I can put my money into. And, you know, I've just got a few satellites up there. They're probably not going to get hit with debris. What's in it for me to participate?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's a definite concern, especially with the newer players in space who may only have one or two satellites. But what's interesting is the folks who have been flying in space the longest, Russia, China, America, are the ones who hold the bulk of the current debris that's up there. And so we have a lot of active satellites. We have a lot of debris, and trying to work within our own ownership is something that's possible. I think part of the challenge is that there are still some technical challenges that are going to require some investment in order to overcome, not that they can't be overcome, but that it will take some money and some time to figure out how to do these things.
Yeah, and let's get into that now. We've covered the international politics side of it. Now, how physically do we make the debris go away?
Sure. So the challenge here is the small things that we cannot see. We can only see things from the ground that are bigger than a softball. That's the 11,000 objects that are in low Earth orbit right now. But the danger comes from the 500,000 things that are the size of a marble. Because we can't see them, we can't really do much about them in terms of remediation or removal. But what we can do is cut off their supply. If we stop allowing things to run into each other, large objects, then we can stop the growth of the smaller population. The challenge there is to remove the larger objects before they have a chance to run into things. In the short term, we do things like post-mission disposal, actually making it a little easier for companies and nations to make the decision to deorbit a satellite at the end of its mission. If we can get that compliance rate up a little bit, then we can slow the growth. And then long-term, actually developing satellites that will fly up to orbit and attach to old pieces of debris and start bringing them back in before they have a chance to run into each other and produce the dangerous small things that we're all worried about.
So scrubber satellites, do we have the technology to do that now?
We have the bits of technology. All of the major pieces are there. It's the integration of the systems and making them function in space and in the manner that we need them to. Most of these objects are not objects that were designed to be rendezvoused with in space, and this is a delicate maneuver. It's a challenge even for rendezvousing capsules with the space station, which we do fairly regularly. To go and grab something that was never intended to be grabbed presents its own unique set of challenges. And then beyond that, the altitude has a major impact on our ability to actually remove them economically. We'd like to take advantage of things like drag, but that doesn't always present itself to us, so we have to do things with propulsion, and that's expensive. And so the pieces are there, our ability to rendezvous, our ability to grab things, but making them work in this type of a situation and making it economical is a challenge.
Briefly, before we wrap up, are you a lone voice in the wilderness, or are people starting to take this seriously?
No, people are starting to take this very seriously. We have an office within our own space agency at Johnson Space Center that tracks orbital debris. The Air Force is very much interested in the congestion of low Earth orbit. On the international scale, we have committees with the UN and other space agencies all looking at different ways to fix this problem, both mathematically and engineering-wise. We even had hearings with the Committee on Space Science and Technology in the U.S. House of Representatives just a couple of weeks ago to talk about the problem and try to decide where we can invest our resources. So people are talking about it, but the more opportunities we get to talk about it and let the general public know what's going on, I think the more traction we'll be able to get.
Well, thanks for talking to us about it today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
That's Tom Percy. He's an engineer, and he's at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. We Americans are maybe the most automotive people on the planet. While owning and driving a car may seem like second nature to a lot of us, our love of cars is actually a unique part of our experience as a country.
And when it comes to cars that symbolize the American dream, there are few cars more iconic than the 1957 Chevy. With sweeping fins and blinding chrome, it's an ode to the carefree, got-it-made image of the American suburbs.
Author and journalist Earl Swift found a rusted-out 57 Chevy wagon, and he charted its life through each of its 13 different owners over the years. Throughout its 57 years of life, that 57 Chevy didn't just see changing hands, but a changing country.
Earl Swift's book is called Autobiography, a Classic Car, an Outlawed Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. Earl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, what is it about a 1957 Chevrolet that makes it so classically American?
Well, I guess you could catalog a bunch of individual assets that the car boasts. You know, it's got a lot of nods to military aviation. It's a product of the jet age, so that's not all that surprising. But it's got fins that look like a Cold War fighter plane's tail and mock machine gun sights slotted into its hood and rubber warheads that jut from the grill. But really, you know, it is more than the simple sum of its parts. It's all of that adds up to a strange sense of optimism that the car seems to have. There's a cheerful buoyancy about it, and I think that it resonated with buyers in 1957 as kind of a rocket sled to the future, and it resonates with people now as kind of this almost sweet, naive bit of nostalgia.
One of the owners of this particular 57 Chevy wagon that you focus on a lot, and we'll get into him a little more in a bit, Tommy Arney, he thinks about cars in a way as fossils of American history, as these symbols that tell a story. Did you buy his view of cars as you were working on this project?
No, I did. I did. Tommy's a very interesting guy. You know, he's a fifth grade dropout, and really he has never cracked a history book in his life. But he does view cars as kind of historical embodiments of America's recent past, and in particular, he sees them as timelines of human experience. That each car is more than an amalgamation of rubber and glass and steel. It's a container for the memories of the people who have owned it. And I found it a surprisingly almost spiritual viewpoint when I met him, because he's not a spiritual kind of guy. But came to agree with him that it's, you know, we view cars differently from any other possession, and they're more like our partners than they are simple possessions. You know, you don't see people having relationships with their coffee makers, but you do see them having relationships with their cars.
Now, this car is not, you know, if you look at it from today's eyes, not a particularly sexy ride. It's not, you know, a convertible or a Mustang. It's a wagon. Why was this car the perfect car to look at sort of American history in a microcosm?
Well, you're right. Although, you know, interestingly, station wagons have a very frumpy image, and they've had one for a long time as a car that trades on practicality more than it does sexiness. But at the time that this car was new in 1957, that was not the case at all. These were the SUVs of their day, the high-end SUVs of their day. They were more expensive than most models in the lineup of every maker, and they symbolized, you know, they pretty much shouted out to the world, if you drove a wagon, that you had arrived at a piece of the American dream of the time, which was the American suburb. It advertised to everyone that you had it made. You had a piece of that backyard grill, easygoing, clean, spacious kind of lifestyle, which was very much in demand. It's interesting for the purpose of the book to chart how the car's place as an image, and the relationship of its owners through time, how they relate to each other. The owners get farther and farther away from that suburban ideal, and the car over time ceases to represent it as well.
Well, the amazing thing you did here, or one of the things you did, is track the provenance of this everyday car. When I think of tracking the history of something, I might think, okay, maybe an antique Rolls-Royce collectible. Sure, you'd know who owned it and be able to track that down fairly easily. How did you track the 13 owners back to when this first got sold?
Well, it proved far tougher than I had any inkling it would be. Had I known how tough it would be, I probably might not have embarked on the project because I assumed, like I think most people do, that there's a paper trail to follow, that the DMV or some state agency keeps track of all the title transfers that have taken place over a car's life. But that's not the case. They shred their records after just a few years or a couple of title transfers, just because the sheer volume of record keeping would overwhelm, you know, their ability to stockpile it. And so what you wind up having to do is find a car with an owner who remembers enough about the person he or she bought the car from that you can figure out who that seller was, and then go to that person and repeat the process and do it over and over and over again.
And one of your buyers said, yeah, it was a doctor or something. His name began with T. He was over on such and such highway. That was one of the thin threads that you had to track, right?
Yeah, it was. And I had to get out the city directory for the approximate year that title transfer would have occurred and go to that highway and start looking for veterinarians and luckily found them. It got tougher than that, actually, but it's through a combination of just obstinance, I guess, and blind luck in a couple of places, was able to piece together the entire chain of 13.
Well, let's start at the beginning from when this car rolled out of the factory. Who was its first owner?
Its first owner was a guy named Nicholas Thornhill, and he was a 60-year-old grandfather, widower, and a boilermaker for the Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Portsmouth, Virginia. And he bought the car at Colonial Chevrolet in Norfolk, Virginia, which was the big Chevrolet dealership of its day, and was still located in downtown Norfolk. This is back when dealerships tended to be vertical buildings. You know, they would take the cars up elevators to various floors of showroom. And was a guy who knew how to keep machines running and knew how to take care of them. And he built a freestanding garage in his backyard for the wagon, and babied it and took meticulous care of it, and kept it for far longer than most owners of the day did. You know, you were expected to trade in a new car after 3 or 4 years max back then, and he kept his for 15, kept it until he died, in fact.
And he's not the only one who built a special spot for this particular car, right?
No, he willed it to his grandson, who 2 or 3 years later sold it to a guy named Sid Pollard, another employee of the Norfolk Naval Shipyard. And Pollard was a heating and air conditioning specialist who also built a backyard garage for the car and wound up keeping it for 8 years.
This is a well-loved car.
Oh, it was indeed. And really, through the first five owners, was kept in very good condition. If you had seen it on the road in the early 1980s, you would have been impressed with it. It was a head-turner. The paint was fresh. The chrome was shiny. It looked fairly new.
And there was
but
one
that changed.
There was one owner, a single mom, who I think sort of encapsulates the changing America that you're getting at through the car. She seemed like a bit of a free spirit. She couldn't even really afford this car.
She couldn't. She loved its style. The looks of the car, the kind of the huge, the overabundance of its style, of its design really appealed to her. And she bought it knowing that its $1,500 asking price was a really long stretch for her and that she would have a hard time keeping gas in the tank with, you know, the rate at which it drank it. And also that, you know, she bought it knowing that she knew nothing about cars. And this was a car reaching that age where it really needed somebody who knew something about mechanics to take care of it. So it wound up in one way in the hands of the person who probably appreciated it the most, but was the least qualified to have it.
We're talking to author Earl Swift about his book Autobiography, a classic car, an outlaw motorhead, and 57 years of the American dream. It's the story of one 1957 Chevy and the 13 plus owners who have driven it over the years.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Owning a car has been for decades an important part of the American experience. What about you? Do you have a memory about a favorite car or car maybe that you've restored? Do you think there is something unique about America's relationship with cars? And what do they symbolize for you? What has been the car in your life that has sort of enfolded all of your memories and your history? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We're back with author Earl Swift talking about his new book, Autobiography, a classic car, an outlaw motorhead, and 57 years of the American dream. It's the story of the 13 owners of one 1957 Chevy.
And we'd like to hear from you with your thoughts, your favorite car that lives large in your memory, one that tells a story about you or a time in your life. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us, Central Time WPR. Earl, before we get to the calls, you spend a lot of time talking about a very recent owner of the car, Tommy Arney. What did he see? The car's not in great shape by this point. What drove him to want the car and want to rebuild it?
Well, Tommy is a car guy. He owns a classic car lot in Moyock, North Carolina. And there were 700 cars of that would all really fall under the heading beater on this lot when he acquired the station wagon. And he did it simply because he knew that it had a provenance. At that point, I had written about the car in the newspaper that covered Moyock, and it came into his hands about 6-7 years ago. And by that time, he was well aware that it had a past and was aware of just how unusual that is with kind of a run-of-the-mill, nothing special about it, you know, middle-of-the-line car. As you said a little while ago, Rob, it's easy to keep track of a classic, a real collector's piece that's been in relatively few hands. But the average car that comes off a lot, you know, now as then, you'd be hard pressed to find most people who remember, you know, who the name of a person they bought a car from 5 years before, or who they sold a car to, and that was the challenge with this. Tommy knew that, and very much appreciated the fact that the car had a history.
We're gonna go to our phones now and take Debbie from Green Bay. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I'm driving my favorite car. It is a 2001 Saturn. And I bought it. I had just moved into a house. I had just adopted my son from Russia, and I bought this car. And it, again, like, made me think about the lady who could barely afford to buy the car. Anyways, 13 years later, I'm still driving it.
Wow.
It's got 249,000 miles on it, and I love it, and I hope it never dies.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that's a great story, and that's one that's clearly, like, encapsulates a part of her life, and it's part of her story with her child, too. Is that something that's typical about what happens when people get attached to cars like this, Earl?
Oh, I think it is. I describe in the book how our relationship with each car we own goes through a number of predictable stages, and they're not unlike those of a doomed marriage. You begin with lust for a car while it sits in the showroom, or if it sits in someone's driveway, and you want it for its curves, for its promise of performance, for the way it smells. That lust gives way to an abiding love, during which you baby the car, show it off to your friends, and that in turn gives way over time to a companionable reliance, which I'm guessing is the stage that Debbie's in now with that 2001 Saturn. And it can last for 20 years with a modern car because they last so doggone long. But back in the day when this wagon was new, you could have expected that to last maybe four or five years max. And then eventually your confidence in the car would be shaken and you would enter a fourth stage, which was heartache, and it had three sub-stages, those being doubt, disappointment, and disgust. And disgust would be equivalent to abandonment, where you take the plates off the car and you leave its smoking carcass on the side of the road.
Mm, we've all been there, I'm afraid. Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Debbie. We'll go to Ted in Brookfield now. Ted, hi.
Hi. I had a 1957 Chevy. And the mistake I made was that after 80,000 miles, I got to thinking, gee, I might have problems with this car. I had had no problems at all. But I thought, you know, 80,000, I should get a different car, which I did. I sold the car to a guy that owned a barber shop. And I was able to drive past the barber shop one day. I stopped in and I said, how's the car? He said, well, we put oil changes in it, and that's it. How many miles? He'd put on 50,000 miles on the car.
Wow.
And had paid essentially nothing to maintain it. And, you know, other than the routine, maybe getting some tires or a battery or whatever. But the other story I want to tell you about a 57 Chevy is a friend of mine had a 57 Chevy. A neighbor across the street from me needed a car. I knew this guy had a car for sale, so I bought it from him. It was a 57 Chevy station wagon. I bought it for this guy. He had gone bankrupt, but he had an idea for a business. He bought the car. He made sales calls in that car. The business survived. He did very well ultimately. And the interesting part about the car is I had to borrow money from insurance to buy the car from my friend.
Huh. Ted, thank you so much for sharing those stories. Two interesting 57 Chevy stories there, Earl. Let's tackle that first one, seller's remorse. Did any of the owners of the 57 Chevy wagon you talked to regret letting it go?
Every single one of them.
Really?
They were all amazed when I contacted them that the car was still on the road. And 201, they all regretted selling it and wished they had it back and wanted to see it, wondered what it looked like, wanted to hear the story of it since. You know, it's it's one of those cars that that you come across pretty infrequently in life. It's, you know, with all due respect to Debbie's 2001 Saturn, that's not going to inspire the same kind of nostalgia that an old style, you know, car from the mid-century does.
I mean, am I right? One of them replaced it with my first car. It was a hand-me-down, the fabled Renault Alliance.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
That, I learned how to push start a car with that thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you learn a lot more about cars when you have the bad ones.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for those stories. And let's move on to Chris joining us in Delafield. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. You're coming through loud and clear.
Oh, thanks. So I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I always hear people say, oh, I, you know, put 100,000 miles on this car, and I sort of feel very sad because I think sometimes we should have higher expectations. My grandmother had a 56 Thunderbird, which she sold to my dad, and he and I shared, and we actually put 1.3 million miles on it.
What? So I know. Like to see the odometer on that puppy.
What's that?
I'd like to see the odometer. I hope you do. You have the car still? Does anybody have it in a garage?
No, he sold it about 10 years ago because the engine parts were getting too expensive. He would have to get them from all over the country. The funny thing is we couldn't get the glove box open for the first few years that we owned the car. Finally, we cracked it open, and there was a pack of Lucky Strikes in there. And we opened it up and just dust poured out all over the floor of the car.
Chris, thank you so much. Hey, Earl, that makes me think, how many miles when you encountered your 57 Chevy wagon, how many miles had racked up on that?
Well, the odometer had been broken for many years, but I'm guessing just shy of 200,000.
Okay. Wow. A million
is
something.
It was on its fourth engine at that point, too.
Have you ever heard of a car with a million miles on it?
Well, you hear, sure. I mean, there are those few, but it would be interesting to hear from Chris whether, you know, that was the original engine. I kind of doubt it. How much of that car was still the car, you know, built of the pieces that were bolted to the frame in 1956 would, you know, that's a real question. I'm guessing most of it, if not all of it, had been swapped out at one point or another.
That's one for the philosophers, like Jason's ship, the paradox.
Absolutely. You bet.
Chris, thanks for the call. We've got Chuck on the line now in Suamico. Chuck, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my 57 Chevy, the 57 Chevy that I had that was black and yellow, I was a disc jockey back in Viroqua back in 1965. I've got a clone to it in my garage right now, and I've owned 20 of them altogether over the years. So I've practically Oh, I'm 65 years old now, so practically all my life I've driven 57 Chevys, and your book is going to have to be in my library.
Chuck, what is it about 57 Chevys that makes you have, what did you say, 20 of them over the years?
Yes, I have had 7 convertibles, 7 two-door hardtops. I've had cars that go through Barrett Jackson. It's an actual disease, and I have absolutely no idea why. I never really heard anybody put it that all, you know, the 1940 Ford had that Chevron thing on it, but I never really thought about all this stuff being military on the car. That's something new.
Thanks a lot for the call. Wow, he's a 57 Chevy addict, Earl.
Well, and of course, one of the owners of the car that I write about, like Chuck, has a thing for that particular model and year. And in the case of Dave Simon, the character in my book, he's owner number 9. He had at that point owned 284 57 Chevys of one type or another when he bought the wagon.
And
often had, you know, 8 or 9 at a time.
Earl, I was going to ask you as we wrap up here, is it important to honor these cars and maybe to hold on to them and keep them around even if we can't restore them to their former glory? Are they more than just cars?
Well, I think that cars are unique among possessions. They're the trusty steeds of the 20th and 21st centuries. They made America what it is today. We've reordered the landscape to accommodate them. Our cities, our products of them, what we eat, what we, you know, how we play, where we work, pretty much every day-to-day activity that we engage in, they have insinuated their way into. So yeah, I think they're worth preserving just as touchstones of where we've been and where we might be headed, because things are going to change. We're running out of the fuels that we've always used for them. We're going to have to come up with some new and pretty creative solutions to that. And cars may not look like they do now for long.
Earl, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, both of you guys.
That's Earl Swift. His new book is Autobiography, 2 words, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. That Renault Alliance I had, yeah, it didn't work often, but when it worked, it was a zippy little car. Do you have that one memory, your first car?
Oldsmobiles. All of my formative cars were Oldsmobiles, like the Olds Delta 88.
Like Carrera. Hand-me-downs? Or?
Yeah, they were hand-me-downs from my grandfather, and yeah, they had some power.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you can still share yours. Tweet us at Central Time WPR with your favorite car memory.